Devin, I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah,
I don't know why y'all are clapping. I haven't even said anything yet. You might be disappointed. And if you don't have the money, just keep coming back. You know, this is one of the places, this meeting and any meeting, where it's like, come as you are, you know, whatever you look like, as long as you're not like profusely bleeding all over the floor, like then we'll take you to the hospital, but then we'll get you back in here. Or you'll find your way back, you know. You know, there were very few places that I went where I actually felt comfortable. And I felt like nobody wanted anything from me. And I felt like, you know, I could just share about how shitty my life was and all these horrible things that I did to people around me, like my family and friends, and you know, under the influence of drugs and alcohol, you know, the things that I did under the influence, because some of the things I wouldn't dream of doing, you know, now, especially now. So there was a lot of joy from sharing when I first came in. Like, you know, the first meeting I really made on my own will, when I was like, all right, enough's enough, was a 2 a.m. meeting at 220 Houston Street. And I just remember, like, this family-like atmosphere, and somebody pointed at me, and they said, you get up there, you get up and speak now. And I said, okay. And I started crying, and I started telling them about how, you know, the girl's gone, the job is almost gone, my apartment's gone, the money's gone, the self-respect is gone, the truth had not been told in a long time. And they found so much joy out of that, and I couldn't understand why. You know, I couldn't understand why, but it was because I was starting to get honest with myself for the first time in a long time, not wearing a mask and letting people know that, yeah, I am fucking scared, I am vulnerable, I am feeling like a total piece of shit, worthless human being who can't do anything right. And you know, they just like snapped, because it's a 2 a.m. meeting, you know, but and they took me out to the diner and bought me food, and it was amazing. And it was a bunch of characters who normally, if I saw them on the street, I would not think I would be friends with, you know, these eccentric people. But before that, like a little bit quick qualification, you know, I come from a family. I was an only child. Both my parents were there. Both my parents were present. My father was drinking throughout most of my childhood. I can't call him an alcoholic, but, you know, my first exposure to alcohol was watching him drink a six-pack of Miller Genuine Draft at the kitchen table, watching the news and eating Triscuits and cocktail shrimp and shit. And I would start being like, hey, Dad, look at me, look at me, look at me. And he'd take these heavy-duty rubber bands and he'd shoot them at me. And that was fun. Like, that's all it took. That's all it took. It was just like, have to dodge a rubber band every now and then and I'm good. But like the first time I got drunk, the first time I ever got drunk, I had Sambuca, Romana Sambuca, and I fell out in the middle of a suburb road in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. And it was nighttime and there was very little street lights. And there was a car going by, And it just so happened that it was a unmarked police vehicle. And they whipped right around real quick, and I was with two of my best friends at the time, and they asked us where we were going, and we said the liquor store, because there's candy there. Because we were going to the liquor store, because they sold candy as well, but there was some other motive, I'm sure. So he put us in the back of the vehicle, and it was a plastic seat, you know, no, like, seat belts or anything, because I guess, you know, people would try to, you know, hang themselves or do whatever they did, but, you know, we were just little kids, so we were, you know, I can't even remember if he put us in handcuffs, but he was doing like 80 down these back roads in the plastic seats, and we were just sliding up against each other, like cracking up against each other, and we're drunk, you know, 14 years old, drunk, in the back of a police car. And then we got home, and I think we watched the Munsters and laughed until we threw up. And then I woke up the next day remembering bits and pieces, and I said, that was the most exciting shit I've ever done. I can't wait to do it again. And I just, every opportunity I got, when there was beer at my buddy's house, his father, you know, had a liquor cabinet full of gin and all sorts of goodies. Marijuana came on the scene. I started hanging out with older guys. Like, I was in high school, I was hanging out with like 30-year-olds who were like local musicians, but we all gravitated around this landscaping company, which I worked at on and off. And there was a shop, and we would all congregate in the shop, and we would play music, and we would start to, you know, we would use drugs and drink, and eventually we would start putting on parties, keg parties with bands, and it became like a real, like, exciting, fun time. It was like, here's this, you know, acreage, this land full of tools and fireworks. We'd make bombs and all this stuff, and it was a lot of fun. It was a whole lot of fun. And, you know, we proceeded to go through music festivals. The rave scene came into my life, and, you know, that sort of went that direction. More brain cells, just, what's the word I'm looking for? They went away. So that carried on and on and on, and it was but, you know, I started to, like, realize, like, I stopped showing up for life. Like, I started being late for my work. My parents started questioning me, you know, about where I was. And, you know, I started not remembering how I got home. I started looking outside, and my bumper of my car was fucking gone. I started to, sorry, I don't know if I can curse, but. All right. So I started, time started lapsing, and I started going through days without even knowing what I did. And I knew that somehow it had to stop somewhere. And I got a DUI, and I lost my license. I had this one night where I took two field sobriety tests in two different states. Shit drunk on Maker's Mark, and I kept it in a cooler. I was going to school in Vermont, so I had venison from a local farm there. And, you know, like, what is that? What's that back there? That's meat. Okay. You know, I thought I was real fucking slick. I really did. I thought I was slick, and I was kind of slick. I mean, I passed two field sobriety tests, but I'm drunk. And I ended up paying like $700 worth of tickets. I eventually lost the license for that car. And then, you know, I started going to Boston every weekend. I didn't have the balls to go abroad during my internship. I wanted to go back home where it was safe with my friends and my bar, you know, and my parents' house. I didn't want to, like, adventure for life. I didn't have a lust for life. Like, I had a lust for, like, company of people that was comfortable, a lifestyle that was instant gratification, and it was easy. There wasn't a lot of work to be done. It was a lot of single-handed curls to my face, and that was good. And, you know, I picked an internship close to home. I started distributing stuff to my friends, and I watched them look at me differently all of a sudden, you know. And I became more, like, my view of people changed. It was like, I'm going to see this person because why? What are my motives? Am I seeking a transaction, or am I being a friend? And I didn't see that till a lot later. I've, you know, put myself in compromising situations where when I look back on it, I'm like, why was I here? Why was I doing this? I got a second OUI where I totaled my vehicle in a blackout. And my buddy was in the front seat, and I got taken to the station. My dad bailed me out, drove me back home. I snuck out of the house and walked four towns over and went to the courthouse, and then did the whole thing through the state by myself. And it was only when I got out of the courthouse that I was not so... Like, I was relieved that, like, okay, I got this taken care of. Yeah, my license is gone for 5 years, and I got to do community service, and I paid $2,000 that I don't have, and I got a, you know, probation officer that, okay, that's fine, whatever. Like, I'm good. It's over, you know? And it was only then that I remembered that my friend was with me, and he was in the front seat, only after I had taken care of my side of the street. And how selfish I was, and to not really think that my drinking could ever hurt another human being, because that is absolutely wrong. Even if I wasn't crashing cars or, you know, getting into sort of not so elegant situations with people. And I threw up immediately when I remembered he was with me. And I called his parents' house. I called my buddy he was staying with. And then I finally called the Cape Cod Hospital, and he was there. And he had a bruised rib, black eye, and just, you know, some minor shit. The airbags were... he was okay. But, you know, it's like... That was like, I gotta stop drinking. I gotta stop drinking. So I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking for 6 months, and then I said, okay, I can drink a little bit. I'll have a beer here and there. And, you know, I still had, at that point, I still had another 5 years of drinking to go. And I went to my first meeting when I was about 16 years old. I was court mandated to go by my school because I was drunk at school, I believe, and they found a pipe in my bag as well. So I said, what are all my friends from school, what are their fathers doing here sharing about their lives? Like, you know, like, I don't care about what's going on with your wife. I don't care, like, you know, that you used to be this shit back in the 70s. You know, like, times were tough. Okay. You know, I had no reference because I hadn't experienced anything firsthand, and that's really what I needed to do. I am a human being that, you know, I like things that are easy, but I'm training myself to, like, appreciate challenges, but also I need to learn firsthand, you know? Like, somebody can tell me not to do something, and a lot of the times it will, like, stick, and I'll be like, okay, yeah, don't touch that, it's hot. I was that baby that... I swear, my parents have videotapes of, there's a fan going, like a big floor fan. I got to get to recovery here. And I would go and walk up to the fan. I put my fingers through the grate. I said, Devin, don't touch it. Devin, don't touch it. And then I would look at my mom and pull back. And I just look at her. I put my hand back slowly, just slowly put it back. And, Devin, don't touch it. So there was a fascination of, like, mischief and doing the wrong thing from, like, a very, very, very young age. And my ego liked it. You know, I could be anybody. I could feel like anything. You know, psychedelics were sort of changed that a bit. Sometimes it got out of control. But anyway, I wound up in New York City and, you know, I was drinking every night, every day, was about to lose my job. I had gotten kicked out of my apartment because I was, well, let's say the bathroom was wherever I made it to be. And that was, so I got kicked out of there. And then I was living with a wonderful young lady. And I again decided to, you know, be a spiritually bankrupt, self-seeking, self-centered, sort of drunk. I was a drunk. I was a fall-down drunk. I would black out, and I would wake up naked on the kitchen floor with her sister looking at me, you know? And it's like, and it was like, not again, you know? The dog didn't even do that shit. I mean, I don't know how dogs get naked, but... So, my mind, I say, like, bottom line, the mental anguish of it, my mind was stepping in the depths of hell every single day. And I kept walking down the street saying, I can't do this, I can't live this life anymore. Eventually, she kicked me out. I spent, like, 3 nights under the pedestrian bridge on 78th Street and the FDR, and because she lived close by there. And then... I found a spot that I could rent by the week, and I continued to drink for a little bit, and then I showed up at that meeting, and I was received with love, I was received with acceptance, I was received with compassion, and trust. For some reason, I mean, granted, I wouldn't say you can trust everybody in the fellowship. But we're all here for a common purpose, and that's so that we can stay sober and to live life on life's terms as full as we can. And you know, as I grow, and that was May 14th of 2013 when I showed up, and you know, after about 90 days, I told somebody that they were my sponsor. I did not have the humility. I was not humble enough to really say, hey, would you be my sponsor? Hey, you know you're my sponsor, right? Right? You know that, right? And he said, yeah, I was afraid you was going to say that. And I've been working with him for like 3 years now. And we've been meeting on a weekly basis for a year and a half. My first 8 months of recovery, and by the way, if you Google the word recovery, it is the act or action of obtaining something that was lost or stolen. My dignity was stolen, my self-respect, my honesty, my humility, my love for myself, what I'm about, my goals, my ambitions, my tenacity. For my lust for life, you know, it was completely gone. So, you know, I started recovery, and for my first 8 months, I did not want to hang out with anybody in my age range. I did not want to be with anybody in my age group, and because I was scared of everybody in my age group, because they were, you know, they were in the same boat. They're on the same sort of like on the come up, like. I would compare myself, and I wouldn't identify. That's what I was too busy doing. So I surrounded myself with older members of the fellowship for my first 8 months, and that worked for me. It was only until an older member forced me, not forced me, suggested I go to this meeting. And then I met some people. And, you know, they became friends to me, and they still are friends to me. And I never had friends that I really know. I can share with them anything. And they'll be like, they might give me some feedback. Five, I got you. Because when I was out there, like, I would start getting, you know what's really bothering me, man? It's like, you know, I don't know if I'm doing exactly what I set out to be doing. I feel like I should be here when I'm here. Like, yeah, like, how about that Bruins game? Like, I couldn't get deep, and I couldn't get spiritual with my friends out there. And I can do that. And I came in here, I never went to church, I never had any conception of a power greater than myself. And, you know, I, you know, that word God scared me. As we understood him. Like, you know, am I going to move a Mack truck? A Mack truck sitting on the street. Am I going to be able to move it? I don't think so. Would I consider that a power greater than myself? Yes, I guess I would. Okay. So there are things that I can't control. And then I started praying as a suggestion, thanking for another clean and sober day, and asking for guidance of my thoughts, actions, and course of my day. And I started using it as a scapegoat. Hey, if anything goes wrong, it wasn't me. It was my higher power's fault. I'm right where I'm supposed to be. and that worked. And I still kind of use that to this day. I definitely still use that to this day. And I also, you know, I would get these moments that would rear these horrible, like, things that I did from my past that would breach into my mind like a big ugly whale breaking through the water. And I would write down the name in wherever, on a napkin, on my hand. I would write down the name, and then I would put it in the columns. And it took a long time. It took me like a year and a half from my first clean date to, you know, get that fourth step in order. And I don't do the steps. I practice the steps, you know, to the best of my ability. And when horrible shit happens, it's a test for me. It's an acid test. It's an opportunity for me to exercise these principles that I've learned in here. I do a daily 10 step consisting of 22 questions about myself. Asking myself if I've been dishonest, loving, caring, kind, accepting, truthful, humble. I can't remember them all because I'm not good at public speaking and all that. But you know, I've met so many people, and I've had so much more fun getting the life back and not winding up with 12 staples in my head and not, like, on my way to an early deathbed, you know, and not, like, actually showing up for life and making a conscious contact with something that I had no idea that existed before I came in these rooms. And I am sponsoring people, and that has been an amazing process for me. Because I never thought that I would, honestly. Like, you want to listen to what I have to say? Well, I don't know. Let me just, but you know what? All it started with, you want to go through the book? You want to just read together and call me if you need something? All right. Some people are like, I suggest you call me every day at this time, or else this, this, and this, and this. It's not a, okay. For me, I believe it's not a cookie-cutter program. I believe that every individual is different, and everybody finds their own way. There are many pathways to spirituality. I do try to ask God to walk with me, and that I can walk within the heart of God. And I can't put God in my heart because he is too large and too big to fit. So I ask to be within his. And no, I'm very grateful to be here. I know there's, you know, there's three shares. There's the share that I think I'm going to share. There's my actual share. And then there's the share that I wish I shared. So I'm just going to leave it with that. Thank you.